Hey guys, Mike back with you. One of the questions we're always asked is, hey, when is a review course going to come to my area? The best resource for you is to check flightbridgeed.com. Courses are being updated almost daily. If there's not one coming next to you, guess what? We've got the fully accredited online university where you can take courses from FlightBridgeEd, FoamFrat, and the list goes on. So check out FlightBridgeEd.com today for more information.
Howdy, y'all. This is Dr. Jeff Jarvis. I want to thank everyone who joined us on our Facebook Live discussion last week where we talked about IV versus IO antidysrhythmics. We had a great showing with some really, really good questions and discussion. If you're one of those folks who decided to get off of Facebook out of fear of all things Zuckerberg, well, first off, I get it. But let me tell you that we mostly talked about potential mechanisms by which IV might be superior to IO in this paper. We also talked about how much faith we ought to put in the results. So if you want more information about that paper, download episode 24, where I briefly, I swear I really did it briefly, reviewed the details of that paper. We got quite a few comments expressing some skepticism that IV really had more of an impact than IO dosing. Right after we wrapped up that recording, a new paper dropped comparing the association between route of administration and survival in cardiac arrest, but this time with epinephrine instead of antidysrhythmics. Now, before we get started, I want to go back to this Facebook thing and get a little bit of your feedback. We've been doing those live web episodes on Facebook primarily because that's the platform we know how to use. So, how many of y'all would like to participate in those live sessions, but you're not on Facebook? Do any of y'all have any suggestions as to options that might be independent of specific social media platforms, something where we could do and be hit Facebook and maybe YouTube, something else? Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts and suggestions. So drop us an email or a tweet or a message on Facebook. You can hit our Facebook group on EMS Lighthouse or the FlightBridge group. You can just drop me an email at jeff.jarvis@flightbridgeed.com or mike.verkest@flightbridgeed.com. And now, a word from Ginger.
What is a lighthouse? It is a tower with a bright light at the top, located at an important or dangerous place. The main purpose of a lighthouse is to serve as a navigational aid and to warn of dangerous areas. Welcome to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast. Illuminating the darkness of current EMS clinical practice with the bright light of science. Here are your hosts, Dr. Jeff Jarvis and Mike Verkest.
What more running audio, you ask? Well, that was a sample of some of the sounds from a trail race I just finished up this morning. So back in the days when I was doing marathons and ultramarathons, I had always wanted to run the Rocky Raccoon Race outside of Huntsville, Texas. I'm not even close to ultra distance anymore, but the good folks at Tejas Trails added a half marathon option into Rocky Raccoon, so I got to check that off my list. I am definitely out of prime running shape, but my friends John Fry and Amanda Jordan pulled me along with them. They kept me running when I might have otherwise dropped into a hike. So thanks, Amanda and John. And now for that new paper. The title of the paper is Intravenous versus Interosseous Adrenaline Administration in Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest, a Retrospective Cohort Study. The lead author is Dr. Zhang, and it was published last week in Resuscitation. Well, I want to get something out of the way right up front. I've gotten several emails and questions on social media about whether we should find anything coming out of China credible. Well, I think that we should be skeptical about any and all research. I don't see any reason to be any more skeptical about Chinese research, well-done Chinese research, than any other. In addition, most of the authors of this paper were associated with Sun Yat-sen University in China, but the supervising author is Dr. Idris from UT Southwestern in Dallas. It looks like Dr. Zhang did most of this project while doing a research fellowship at UT Southwestern. Finally, it is based on data from the ROC cardiac epistry that was collected from ROC sites in North America. Most importantly, after reading this paper, I found it to be a very well done, very well written paper, certainly better than most of the papers I peer review. So yes, I find this to be a credible paper worthy of our attention. That doesn't mean I find its conclusions to be ironclad or causative. But let's get into the paper itself to talk more about what they did and what they found. Now, as I mentioned, this was a retrospective analysis of the ROC Cardiac Epidemiologic Registry, or EPISTRY. If you're not familiar with this registry, it's a data set of patients in cardiac arrest reported by the agencies that are participating in the various ROC trials. Although these patients were likely included in other studies, the EPISTRY itself is not from a specific trial. This version of the dataset includes arrests occurring between April 1, 2011 and June 30, 2015. Now let's take a look at the PICO question asked in this paper. Population. They included all adult out-of-hospital cardiac arrest who had resuscitation attempted. They excluded patients 89 years or older, those with DNR orders, and those with an obvious cause of their arrest. Things such as trauma, electrocution, overdose, foreign body, infections or sepsis, snake bites, Godzilla attacks, that type of thing. So basically, they only wanted cardiac etiology arrest. They also excluded any patient who did not get epinephrine at all, or who did get epi, but by a route that wasn't clear. They also excluded patients who got their epi via an IV that was established prior to arrival, or, and God, please tell me there weren't many of these, who got their epi by ET tube. Now, to avoid having to figure out how to deal with multiple interactions, they eliminated patients who received epi via both IV and IO, and I think that was pretty wise. Their intervention and control groups. So they took all of the patients that were included once they used their inclusion and exclusion criteria, and they broke them up into two buckets. Bucket number one was those people who got epi through an IV, and bucket number two was the group of patients who got their epi via IO. And those two buckets served as both the intervention and the control. Now, unfortunately, this data set does not have the location of either the IV or the IO. That means we don't have an idea of whether the IO was tibial or humeral head. Now, given the time range of this study, that was 2011 to 2015, I'd assume that the vast majority of IOs were placed in the tibia, but we don't know that for sure. Likewise, it's possible that all of the IVs were actually placed in the foot, but I find that pretty unlikely. Like most arrests, in my experience and probably yours, most of the IVs were placed in the antecubital fossa. All right, so what was the outcome? The primary outcome was survival to hospital discharge. Their secondary outcomes were pre-hospital arrest and hospital discharge with favorable neurologic outcome. So for the analysis, they did some interesting things here that I think are really commendable. So the fundamental analysis was to look for an association between route of epi administration and survival. The smart thing they did was recognize that far more patients received epi via IV than IO, and the baseline groups had differing characteristics that could cloud their interpretation. So first, they did a straightforward regression analysis comparing outcome by route of administration and controlling for all of the variables we might expect to influence that association. Things like age, gender, whether it was witnessed, whether there's bystander CPR, the response time, initial rhythm, that type of thing. They then used a one-to-one propensity matching to identify a group of IO patients who had baseline characteristics that were similar to those in the IV group. Now, once they did, they repeated the analysis on that propensity-matched group. Now, in case any of my fellow R nerds out there are wondering, they used two packages to do this propensity matching, MatchIt and Standard Diff, or STDDIFF. Now, I've never used either of these packages. For that matter, I've never done a propensity matching study, but I'm definitely going to look at them. I'm really thankful that the authors included this package information to give me an idea where to look. All right, let's get to the results. So there were just a touch over 67,000 patients in the EPISTRY, and 53% of them met their inclusion and exclusion criteria. Of the 37,733 that were included, 78% got their epi through an IV, with the remaining 21 getting it through an IO. Now, for the overall group, the percent of ROSC was, or the rate of ROSC was 23%, survival to discharge was 5.2, and functional survival was 3.7. Now remember, this was all cardiac etiology arrest and not just Utstein patients. In fact, 78% of these patients, much like most of our arrest patients, had an initial non-shockable rhythm. The authors really laid their data out well in their tables. I'm a table kind of guy. I would much rather get my results from a well-fashioned table than prose. My eyes just glaze over when I'm trying to read results in sentence format, but well-laid-out data tables really make things pop for me, and this paper was a great example of how to do that well. So I've included the key tables in the show notes, so take a look at them. Well, let's start with Table 1. That shows overall unmatched baseline characteristics of the patients. And as we would expect, because these patients were not randomized to IV or IO, the two groups were not balanced. The IV group was older, more male, had more bystander CPR, they had longer response times, more shockable rhythms, and took longer from dispatch to first epi dose. Among this unmatched group, patients getting epi by IV had higher rates of all outcomes. Survival to discharge was 5.8% in the IV group versus 3.1% in the IO group, giving an absolute difference of 2.7% higher survival to hospital discharge if you get your epi through your IV. Now, Table 2 shows the baseline characteristics for the propensity-matched group. Now, as you would expect, these two groups were similarly matched and had no differences in any of the groups. Among this matched group, all outcomes were also higher for the patients getting epi through an IV. Survival to discharge in this group was 5% in the IV group and 3.4% in the IO group for an absolute difference of 1.6%. Now, Table 3 shows the results of their regression analysis. When comparing IV to IO, the odds ratio for survival to hospital discharge in the unmatched group was 1.5, with a confidence interval of 1.3 to 1.8. Now, as a reminder, this means the odds of survival were 50% higher when epi was given via IV than IO. The results in the propensity matched group was similar. Interestingly, this advantage for IV versus IO was seen for all outcomes. Let me just give the adjusted odds ratios here from the propensity matched group. ROSC was 1.4, survival to hospital discharge was 1.5, survival to hospital discharge with functional neurologic capability was 1.8. And all of these were statistically significant, meaning their odds, the 95% confidence interval, did not cross zero. So they were statistically significant, but the question is were they clinically significant? Well, I would argue that a 50% higher odds of survival is clinically significant. Now, finally, they did an additional sensitivity analysis based on initial rhythm. So these results are displayed in Table 4. They found higher odds of all outcomes in both shockable and non-shockable rhythms. They are actually highest for functional survival in non-shockable rhythms with an odds ratio of 2.2. Now that's 100%, 120% higher odds of survival when you get your epi through an IV versus an IO. As with that secondary analysis of the ALP study, the discussion is great in this paper. The big question most of us have with this concept that drugs may be more effective in arrest when given IV than IO is how. So what's the mechanism? Why might this be true? So the discussion in this paper does a great job of enumerating the potential mechanisms, and it gives some great references for these. So if you're looking for a bibliography of papers supporting the various mechanisms, definitely download this paper. So let's go over a couple of them. So multiple papers demonstrate that IO has a higher first attempt success and can be done quicker. This would suggest higher rates of survival via IO. Now again, that's assuming that epinephrine does anything meaningful here, but I think all of the evidence says epinephrine will increase ROSC and increase survival to admission. So if that's the case, we would expect higher rates of survival with IO, but that's not what we see. This suggests that time may not be the predominant mechanism. Drugs given through IO must first pass through the marrow, which might lead to some sedimentation or trapping of the drug in the marrow. That might lead to a decreased concentration in the central circulation. That's one possibility. It's also possible that the final volume of distribution might be similar, and there's definitely some evidence to suggest that. But the time to reach that volume might be faster with IV than IO as a result of maybe this sedimentation. Now, like we talked about in the prior study, the site of the IO might make a difference. Several papers demonstrate a faster time of central circulation with sternal and humeral IOs than with tibial. While the general practice of EMS during this time period was to start tibial IOs and arm IVs, this paper didn't have specific data to confirm location. One other possible mechanism? It's possible that the increased endothoracic pressure seen with compressions may impede venous return more from lower extremities than upper extremities. This would be expected to further delay tibial epinephrine, and if time to maximum concentration is a key factor, that should result in lower survival rates with tibial IO administration, just like we saw. Limitations. As with all papers, this one has some limitations. The biggest is that this was not an RCT with patients randomized to get epi via IV versus IO. It was a retrospective registry study. As such, it can only present associations and cannot determine causation. These results are best used for hypothesis generation to support a future RCT. Now, the big challenge with retrospective studies is the notion of unmeasured confounding variables. Perhaps there is something fundamentally different about patients who got epi via IV than those who got it via IO. Perhaps, but I think the authors did as good a job as they could of attempting to control for this potential. First, they performed a multivariate logistic regression that controlled for the known measured confounders. And second, they performed a propensity-matched analysis that created two groups that were equal in all of the known matched characteristics. The biggest weakness I can see in this paper is a limitation of the underlying dataset and not the paper itself. One of the leading potential mechanistic explanations for these results is that the location of an IO matters. This dataset just doesn't have that information. We're forced to make assumptions on the location based on what standard practice during that time was. I do think that's probably a fair assumption, though. Okay, so what's my bottom line? I think this was a very well done and well written study. I'm a big fan of readability, And despite English presumably not being the native language of the authors, this was one of the best written and most readable papers I've read in a long time. I really did enjoy reading this paper. So it comes on the heels of the ALP secondary analysis showing a similar advantage with antiarrhythmics. I think the signal-to-noise ratio here is high enough to convince me that there's something going on. We're just seeing this signal in too many papers. Now, I don't know if this is a function of IV versus IO, or it's a function of lower extremity versus upper extremity. My bottom line, though, is that I'm making a protocol change in this year's revisions to our SOCs. We're making IV access above the waist, meaning either arms or EJs, the preferred location. If IV isn't readily achieved, we'll place an IO, but we'll use the proximal humerus over the tibia. Finally, I hope we'll see this question directly answered with an IV versus humeral head IO RCT. I think that type of study will give us the results we want, and there are some ways to randomize that. As always, I hope y'all found this podcast informative and helpful. If you did, please subscribe and give us a great rating to help others find our pod. We'd love to hear your thoughts, questions, and suggestions. You can reach us on Facebook or Twitter. On Facebook, I'm at Dr. Jeff Jarvis, and Mike is at Mike Verkest. Thanks for listening, and I hope y'all have a great week.
You've been listening to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast, a proud member of the FlightBridge Ed podcast family and a Fire Dog production. Visit FlightBridgeEd.com for more information.